I think. How far down the list? Well, we want you, there's no connection there. You make whatever connection you need to make with that. But we need you to really support this radio station so that we can continue bringing you voices like Beyond the Pale, radio's home for the Jewish left. We need you to do that. 833-922-4692. If no one picks up your call right away, not to worry. Just leave your name and your number, and someone will call you right back. Please do that. 833-922-4692. It's 10 a.m. here in New York, and it's Friday. Coming up at 11 will be Heart of Mind with Catherine Davis. But right now, stay tuned for On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital with Esther Iverum.
From Washington, D.C., this is On the Ground. UN human rights experts say that the genocide against Palestinians perpetrated by Israel and supported by the U.S. and NATO countries is also destroying international and human rights laws enacted after the carnage of World War II.
It's not just about Gaza or the Palestinians. It has ripple effects across the whole legal system. And we've seen that there are all kinds of attacks on international institutions and fundamental norms of international law. And once those red lines start getting eroded so forcefully, it doesn't take long for the system to break down and break apart very quickly.
As Israel continues to kill, displace, and starve people in Gaza, in the West Bank, and in prisons documented as torture and death camps, we spend the hour hearing from these UN human rights experts, including Francesca Albanese, Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories. She and the others held a press conference March 12, 2025, at the United Nations office in Geneva.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us at this press briefing on the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory by special procedures mandate holders. We'll have four special rapporteurs briefing you today, so let me quickly introduce them so we can get started. On the podium today, we have the Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights, Ben Saul, and the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Michael Fakhri. And joining us online today will be Francesca Albanese, the Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. And we also have with us a Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, Margaret Satterthwaite. Each of the speakers will have brief opening remarks, after which they will take your questions. We'll begin with opening remarks by Ms. Albanese. Special Rapporteur, you have the floor.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I wish to salute in particular my colleagues, special rapporteurs for this opportunity. This is the third press conference that we hold within UN premises on the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, and the threats continue to rise both for the Palestinians, I would say, by extension for the Israelis, for other peoples in the region, and for the multilateral order that we are all part of. So there are two elements on which I would like to concentrate, to focus on for these brief opening remarks. And one is the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, and then how the dismemberment of the multilateral order and through the violations of basic tenets of international law is going to impact all of us. And it feels like being a Cassandra while repeating over and over the same warnings. So the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory continues to be tragic. Genocide being a process, not an act, it's something that cannot be contained unless, especially when it's been inflicted through violent and destructive acts like the ones unleashed against the entire population trapped in Gaza, it cannot be undone unless it's significantly remedied. And this is not the case yet. So the genocide in the effects of the genocide in the Gaza Strip for the over 2 million Palestinians trapped there will continue to be felt because of the extreme destruction, the environmental crisis that has been created, the destruction of livelihood. And I'm sure that my colleague Michael Fakhry will speak to this because he has been brilliant in exposing how the destruction of food sovereignty speaks to genocidal practices being part of a process and not acts in and of themselves. But even if no one intervenes today, if no more bombs dropped, you know, if no more bullets are shot against the people in Gaza, the genocide will continue because there are no ways to remedy the destruction, that the seeds of the various forms of destruction that have been planted in Gaza. Let's not forget, genocide can be identified in two main elements. One is determination to destroy a group as such. And second, it must be understood through the who the victims are. Here we are talking of a group identified as such, the Palestinians identified as such. And this leads me to speak of the other part of this genocide. Already in October 2024, I warned the international community in New York that the genocidal violence was leaking out in the West Bank. And the violence is now as acute as ever, because the elements that identified 5-6 months ago, the destruction of health infrastructure and other civilian infrastructure together with livelihood and food sovereignty, the arbitrary mass killing of Palestinians in the West Bank and the infliction of severe bodily and mental harm through the mass arbitrary detention of Palestinians, including children, and the brutalization of the Palestinians in Israeli custody, yes, including through systematic torture, including rape, that in some cases, like in the case of Dr. Al-Bush, have led to death. This is something that has only increased in brutality. Now we know where Israel, what I was denouncing as the pursuit of the policy of realizing Greater Israel, is leading to forced displacement of the Palestinians from the Gaza Strip, from the West Bank. And again, while ethnic cleansing is not a crime per se, it consists, and it's been recognized as such, it might include other crimes like crimes against humanity and genocide. So Israel is destroying the Palestinian people in the pursuit of ethnic cleansing of what remains of Palestine. Last comment concerns the international legal order. Already 1 year ago, I denounced the Israeli humanitarian camouflage, the fact that Israel was not denying the violence that you had unleashed against the Palestinians. It does not deny the leveling of civilian infrastructure, the killing of Palestinians. It had justified it as supported by military necessity. Those who die are either collateral damage or military targets or human shields. And I said, this is going to lead to a new script to conduct a war that will lead us to face a world without civilians. And not even 6 months later, Israel had implemented that script in Lebanon, and now it's being exported to other places. So again, I don't know how many warnings the international community will need to receive, but the point is that we have already entered a world where what has protected us until now, although we have to recognize that the multilateral order has not served everyone equally, it's crumbling, and we will miss it very much when it's no longer there. We will miss human rights very much when we are no longer able to protect us. Thank you.
Thank you, Special Rapporteur. Our next speaker will be Professor Ben Saul, the Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism and Human Rights.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for coming. Firstly, let me acknowledge the leadership of my colleague, the Special Rapporteur on the situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, She has been subject to a campaign of smearing and intimidation for at least the last 18 months, and I call on all states to defend the special procedures system from these kinds of outrageous attacks. The Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food has also been subject to this kind of intimidation, and all states need to speak out when that kind of conduct happens. I want to make 4 points. Number one, I firstly denounce the US president's proposal to take over, depopulate, and colonize Gaza. It would shatter the most fundamental rules of international order and the United Nations Charter since 1945. It's manifestly illegal to invade and annex foreign territory by force, to forcibly deport its population, and to deprive the Palestinian people of their right to self-determination. Any plan for the day after must be based on the popular will of the Palestinian people, including under any Arab proposal. The abysmal political failure to address the root causes of violence in Palestine as required by the UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy, or to challenge impunity prevailing there, has condemned the whole region to an endless cycle of suffering and vengeance. There can never be a sustainable peace without justice according to international law, including self-determination, return of Palestinian land, all of it, evacuation of illegal settlements, compensation for violations, and return of refugees. The apocalyptic violence in Palestine also signals to other states that there are no consequences for decimating whole civilian societies, returning us to the scorched earth tactics of the colonial counterinsurgency era. Second point, I deplore the resumption of apparently unconditional arms transfers by the United States to Israel. Recently, the US approved the transfer of more than $7.4 billion worth of arms and munitions and rescinded the Biden administration's 2024 national security memo that required assurances that US weapons would not be used to violate humanitarian law. Now, that memorandum was itself ineffective in practice, but loosening constraints further will enable more violations. Throughout this conflict, I and other mandate holders have repeatedly called on the United States and Germany in particular as the major arms exporters to halt transfers to Israel due to the clear risk of violations of humanitarian law in breach of obligations to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions, prevent crimes under the Genocide Convention, and in the case of Germany and others, to comply with their obligations under the Arms Trade Treaty. Third point, I condemn two recent Israeli laws that impede the work of the United Nations Relief Works Agency in Palestine. UNRWA is indispensable, as the Security Council, the General Assembly, and the Secretary General have said, not only in providing and coordinating humanitarian relief at a time of acute disaster in Gaza, but also in delivering essential services for civilians in ordinary times across the Palestinian territories. Israel's move violates its obligations to facilitate humanitarian relief and maintain law and order as the occupying power, its duty to cooperate with UNRWA's mandate under the United Nations Charter, and the privileges and immunities of the United Nations as an international organization. It also undermines the stability of the ceasefire and prospects for peace, and sets a terrible precedent for unilateral disengagement from United Nations operations. Last point, I condemn Israel's continuing illegal military provocations in the wider region, most recently including further occupation of Syrian territory in the Golan Heights and strikes to unilaterally and preventively disarm the Syrian military on the pretext of countering terrorism at some distant point in future. These are additional to illegal aggressions and threats of force in Lebanon and Iran over the last year. Such acts destabilize the whole region, including a peaceful transition of power in Syria. The world's active and passive enabling of lawlessness and impunity in Gaza and Palestine has contagiously emboldened Israel to do the same elsewhere. I urge all countries to stand united against coercion by global or regional powers that seeks to break the international legal system. The world must never accept a lawless world dominated by brute force that endangers all of us. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Professor Saul. And we'll go back to the speakers joining us online now with the Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, Margaret Satterthwaite. Ms. Satterthwaite, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I would also like to recognize the crucial work of my colleagues, and especially the Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territory and the Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food both of whom have been mercilessly smeared and attacked for undertaking their important work to protect human rights. And this is not only an introductory remark, it's an example of what I'm going to focus on today. There's been a turn to attack and punish the very mechanisms set up to protect against grave human rights violations. What we're seeing is a broad attack on the laws, institutions, and mechanisms, as well as the personnel that make up the international rule of law. At the time when these laws and mechanisms are needed most, they're being dismantled and attacked. I want to be clear. The institutions have come through in our time of need. The ICC has issued arrest warrants, not only for the leaders of Hamas, but also for Israeli leaders. The ICJ has issued provisional measures ordering Israel to cease all actions that pose a risk or constitute acts of genocide. The ICJ has made clear that Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful and must be brought to a prompt end. These actions were reasoned, deliberate, and based on clear law that the international community of states has developed and applied over many decades. They were implemented by judges, prosecutors, and lawyers, acting with careful deliberation. They were not taken in haste, but instead were acts of duty and commitment. Law, not war. These are the words of the late Benjamin Ferenc, a prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. That was the dream of those who created the UN, the International Court of Justice, and the International Criminal Court. But now we see tragically an effort to punish, block, and deny the strength and righteousness of this system. On February 6th, President Trump of the United States signed an executive order which states that, quote, any effort by the ICC to investigate, arrest, detain, or prosecute protected persons constitutes an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. He then declared a national emergency to address this so-called threat. The order opposes and expects our allies to oppose all actions by the ICC against the United States, Israel, or any other ally of the United States that, quote, has not consented to ICC jurisdiction. On February 13th, 1 week later, Karim Khan, the court's chief prosecutor, was added to the U.S. list of specially designated nationals and blocked persons. Those on this list are barred from doing business with Americans and face restrictions on entry to the U.S. This list is normally reserved for those who have committed acts of terrorism or grave human rights crimes. The U.S. has placed the prosecutor responsible for bringing cases against those who commit such crimes on the list alongside them. At this time, only Mr. Khan has been specifically sanctioned. However, the executive order hangs like a sword of Damocles over anyone engaging with the court in relation to the situation on Palestine, since it authorizes the U.S. Secretary of State to sanction anyone that secretary determines to, quote, have directly engaged in any effort by the ICC to investigate, arrest, detain, or prosecute a protected person, unquote. Or to have materially assisted, sponsored, or provided material, financial, or technological support of to such person. In addition, the executive order imposes a blanket visa ban on any non-U.S. individuals whom the Secretary of State finds are employed by or acting as agents of the ICC. This is a stunningly broad visa ban. It appears to apply to any ICC staff member or agent who's not a U.S. person. Potentially up to 900 persons, plus people who specifically might have U.S. children or other U.S. relatives. These ICC sanctions sit inside a broad framework for enforcement. U.S. criminal and civil penalties can be placed on U.S. persons and others who interact with sanctioned people in ways that have even a fleeting connection to the United States. This means that human rights defenders, investigators, and even legal advisors, potentially anyone who supports the prosecutor's important work, could be exposed to criminal or civil penalties. This would appear to include those working on cases not only involving the situation in Palestine, but also those focused on Ukraine or Darfur, where the U.S. has supported those investigations. The consequences of these sanctions ripple far beyond the prosecutor and even the court itself. They strike an attack and a strike on the global rule of law. They strike at the very heart of international criminal justice system. The jurisdiction of the ICC has been litigated and settled by rulings of the ICC and is not being exercised contrary to international law. It is being carefully applied in a situation where grave human rights crimes are occurring. With this order, the U.S. has empowered war criminals by seeking to punish the ICC, denying justice and reparation to victims around the world. These sanctions make a mockery of the decades-long quest to place law above force and atrocity. Justice must equally apply to all without exception. Upholding international law cannot be a selective process. It is a shared responsibility that strengthens rather than threatens global security. Now, since the sanctions were imposed, many member states of the ICC have condemned these steps by the United States. 79 countries have released a joint letter that warns sanctions would increase the risk of impunity for the most serious crimes. Other states have emphasized that they will continue to work with and to support the ICC, making clear the essential role played by the court in ending impunity. Now, as the Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers, I want to state unequivocally that the legal professionals at the ICC, who work tirelessly to drive accountability and justice across the globe, must not be targeted for this important work. Our efforts to uphold international law rely on the work of ICC prosecutors, judges, investigators, and all of the support staff at the court. Imposing sanctions on court personnel for carrying out their professional responsibilities constitutes a flagrant violation of human rights and undermines the principles of judicial independence and the rule of law. In closing, I will note also that the U.S. sanctions against the ICC would appear to amount to offenses against the administration of justice under Article 70 of the Rome Statute. Article 70 punishes efforts to impede or intimidate an official of the court or to retaliate against an official of the court on account of duties performed by that official. It is crucial that we call these actions out for what they are and that states stand together to oppose this attack on the international rule of law. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we will now hear from Mr. Michael Fakhri, Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. You have the floor, Special Rapporteur.
Thank you, everyone. In many ways, I'm going to echo much of what my colleagues have said, but I will focus on the humanitarian issue, drawing not just from my own work, but the work of my colleagues, the Special Rapporteurs on Housing, the Special Rapporteur on Health and Water, amongst others. We're at the stage where we're not asking anymore what's happening. It's very clear. Israel announces what it's doing with impunity. It is using Palestinian civilian lives as leverage. We're in a moment now where Israel is yet again denying humanitarian aid in Gaza. We're at a moment where violence is escalating across Palestinian territory. So that means Gaza, East Jerusalem, and especially the West Bank. We're at the stage where we're not arguing, what is this? This is genocide. This is crime against humanity. These are war crimes. Because Israel tells us that's what they want to do. Israel has been using civilian lives as leverage throughout the last several months, over a year. The other thing I want to point out, and to echo what others have said, is the importance of UNRWA. UNRWA is indispensable, and UNRWA is still active. They are still doing their job despite the pressure that they're under. Despite the Israeli legislation trying to block their work, despite the threats to their funding, UNRWA is providing essential social services, health, even education under impossible circumstances. But also, UNRWA is ensuring and recording and tracking and protecting Palestinian human rights. UNRWA cannot be replaced. Every UN humanitarian agency has said as such, as has the Secretary General. So what I want to focus more on is what is to be done and what is at stake. How is Israel able to starve 2.3 million people so quickly and so completely? This is the fastest starvation campaign in modern history. Israel announced its intent to starve Palestinians on October 9th, 2023, and continues to do so, what we see is Israel just speeds up or slows down its violence. This is not a ceasefire by any definition. This is a slowing down of military violence, but a continued unfolding of death through starvation. We're also seeing a moment where, after 58 years of illegal occupation, Israel is now announcing and trying to implement an annexation plan. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood up before the UN General Assembly in September 2023, announcing and showing the annexation plan by Israel. He held a map before the General Assembly, and it was a map of so-called Israel, and I say so-called because it had erased all Palestinian territory. September 2023. And that's what we're seeing now, and that's what the International Court of Justice recognized in its advisory opinion on the legal consequences of the illegal occupation since 1967. This is where we're at. Israel announces its attempts to ethnic cleansing. Israel announces its genocidal intent. It announces its starvation campaign and that it implements it. So what's also at stake, alongside the Palestinian people's right to self-determination and right of return, is the global order itself, to echo my colleagues. What is at stake is U.S. geopolitical power and European unity. And what countries around the world have finally recognized is that when Israel attacks the UN, when Israel kills a record number of UN staff, when Israel shoots at UN peacekeepers in Lebanon, Israel is attacking everyone. I've heard, this is not my quote, this is what I've heard from ambassadors from around the world. What is to be done? The International Court of Justice, in its advisory opinion, as was followed up by a General Assembly resolution, has told us what should be done. Sanctions. And I'm not talking about the sanctions that my colleague highlighted, the unilateral sanctions by the United States. What I'm talking about are internationally, legally authorized sanctions against Israel. Broad-based, economic, political, diplomatic, cultural sanctions is the only thing that's going to ensure a permanent ceasefire. Second, reparations. I'm wary of people who talk about reconstruction and the day after and all of this. Because what was the condition of Gaza on October 6, 2023? 50% of people in Gaza were hungry. 80% were dependent on humanitarian aid. The reason Israel destroys the food system in Gaza is not just to make people hungry. It's to force them into the dependency on humanitarian aid. It's therefore easier for Israel to use humanitarian aid as a weapon. So that destruction of Gaza's food system should be paid attention to. This will have long-term impact. So when we talk about reparations, what does that mean? It means Israel is responsible to ensure the Palestinian people live in dignity and no longer face any risk of starvation or any risk of genocide. That's what we should be focusing on. Thank you very much.
That was Michael Fakhry, UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. Before him, Margaret Satterwhite, UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Judges and Lawyers. Ben Saul, UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms While Countering Terrorism. And first was Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, occupied since 1967. All were speaking at a press conference at the United Nations office in Geneva on March 12, 2025. This is On the Ground. Now more from the press conference.
The experts will now take questions. Please state your name and organization before asking a question, and it would also be good if you indicate which expert you want to which your question is directed.
Thank you. Robin Millard from AFP. Mr. Saul, you spoke about President Trump's plan for the Gaza Strip. I'd like to ask you and anyone else you might want to say something about what do you make of the Arab plan which has been put forward. Thank you.
And happy for my colleagues to answer on this one as well. I mean, certainly credit to the Arab states involved in that plan for rejecting the US proposal, first obvious point. My key response is that it's a plan for reconstruction of basic services and housing and all of that is good. It's also supposed to be managed under the auspices of the Palestinian Authority, which is positive in the sense that that's a Palestinian entity. Of course, there are questions about the representativeness of the Palestinian Authority these days, its legitimacy in terms of acceptability to the Palestinian people as a whole. So I don't think we can take it for granted that the Palestinian Authority expresses the will of the whole Palestinian people. At the same time, I think the critical problem with the plan is that it's not a long-term settlement of the conflict. I mean, it's a band-aid. It's rebuilding what was destroyed and taking us back to where we were 18 months ago. I mean, really, that's what it looks like, with maybe Hamas a bit weakened politically in that process. You know, the UN Global Counterterrorism Strategy, Pillar 1, commits all countries, and Israel consented to this, to address the root causes of terrorism. And they include political exclusion, marginalization, economic inequality and poverty, poor governance or lack of governance, and most critically, state violations of international human rights law. So until you fix that fundamental violation of Palestinian right to self-determination, fix compliance with what we know the International Court of Justice says is required, that is an end to settlements, an end to occupation, resumption of Palestinian governance of Palestinian land, we're going to be back in this position in, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, as we have been in the endless cycle of violence since 1967, and I go back to the 1920s because we know this has been going on for much longer. But happy to hear from my colleagues on this one as well.
Would any other expert like to weigh in on the same question? Ms. Albanese.
Yes, I know that the current U.S. president has attracted much attention and criticism. And there are two aspects to what he brings to the fore. One is content and one is form. And clearly, I have to say that sometimes it's surreal, it's very often grotesque, the way he refers to people outside the U.S. I don't think that this is something limited to Palestine. And yeah, again, I sometimes feel that there is probably it's intentional psychological overwhelming, so that we and policymakers most probably don't know how to react. However, the content, while the U.S. U.S. politics under the current administration is terrible in many ways, I have to say that when it comes to Palestine, the worsening is in the margins, if there is worsening at all, because the U.S. has always been that lawlessness-driven, international law negligence-driven when it comes to Palestine. This, the violence that has been unleashed against the Palestinians historically, but most remarkably in the last 16 months, has been financially, militarily, economically, and politically enabled by the previous U.S. administration. So again, we shouldn't be distracted from that. And also, people talk, media as well, tend to refer to the Trump's plan to forcibly displace the Palestinian. No, this is the Israeli plan to displace the Palestinians. And President Trump's, as its persona, is just saying that out loud. And yes, it's scary that forced displacement and other crimes are becoming overtly part of the U.S. foreign policy. I mean, the other side of the coin is that this is the way the U.S. Has run politics vis-a-vis Palestine for a long time. And again, we shall not forget what's happening to the West Bank. The West Bank is the litmus test of the ethnic cleansing that Israel aims to do to Palestine. 40,000 people have been made homeless in 1 month. I mean, this would be on the front page of any newspaper. This should be talking on TV. Imagine if this had been done to the Israelis. The fact that policymakers and media don't pick it up is a reflex of a racial bias.
Thank you, Ms. Albanese. Are there any other questions? Yes, please go ahead.
Moussa Assi, Al-Mayadin TV. OK, c'est bien, merci. Alors la question, depuis le cessez-le-feu à Gaza, Israël a pris plusieurs fois des mesures pour stopper la nourriture et les aides humanitaires vers le territoire de Gaza. Est-ce que pour vous, c'est une continuité de crimes, de guerre, ou bien un élément toujours de génocide que Israël commet envers les Gazaouis?
Ms. Albanese, please go ahead.
I think that the danger of forced displacement of the Palestinians is real since the arrival of British boots in historical Palestine. And it has become more and more real with every passing day for the Palestinians. There has been, forced displacement has been a constant. And I know that because my contribution to scholarship is on 100 years of forced displacement of Palestinians. So I can tell you that there have been two trends: low forced displacement, low intensity forced displacement, which has been constant, and it has been implemented through decisions of taking Palestinian property piece of land by piece of land, home by home, school by school, then has escalated in three historical moments. But otherwise, it has always been constant. And we are talking of hundreds of thousands of people forcibly displaced, including from the occupied Palestinian territory, away from major instances of armed conflict. But in major instances of armed conflict, as in 1947-49, the Nakba, of whom Palestinians are all survivors one way or another. In 1967, under the fog of war, Israel forcibly displaced 350,000 plus Palestinians, destroying everything they had left behind, like in 1947-1949, and preventing their return. This is why, on the 14th of October, 2023, like 1 week after the assault, I said, this is the risk, because this is what I saw being the trend, the risk of forcible displacement of the Palestinian is real. So how to answer, and this has been the third peak. And of course, you know, it's never a given. Israel has tried all it could to forcibly displace the Palestinians, and including, if you read Michael Fakhri's report on food sovereignty, in conjunction with another colleague's report, Pedro Arrojo, the special rapporteur of the right to water, and Cartography of a Genocide, the report produced by Forensic Architecture, you understand that Gaza has always been driven by this attempt to forcibly displace the Palestinians. And now it's happening. The resistance has come from the Palestinians. And I'm not talking of armed resistance. I'm talking to the fact that they stayed put, because the reactment of the Nakba through the violence that they experienced made them feel this is the last piece of Palestine that we have, and we are not going anywhere. So this is why now many are talking of supporting migration so as to make them move voluntarily, because there is no other way than, and through bombing, it will not work. They are going to be killed all. So this is the reality. The danger is real, but so is the Palestinian attachment to the land and resistance to the land.
Just to build on Francesca, and thank you for that question. So undoubtedly, Israel's continued denial of humanitarian aid is a continuation of war crimes, genocide, and crimes against humanity. So I want to add, what is to be done? So I mentioned sanctions. So how has Israel been able to do this? It's, as Francesca has noted, this didn't start in 2023. This didn't even start in 1967. You can go back to 1948, and you can go back to the Balfour Declaration before that. Over the decades, Israel has created a legal and political regime designed to displace Palestinians from their territory by making them vulnerable to starvation and violence. So in the report that Francesca noted, that I, for, to understand, how is Israel able to do what it was doing? Not only does it make Palestinians vulnerable by destroying their food system, making them reliant on humanitarian aid, and not only then does Israel use humanitarian aid as a weapon and as a bargaining chip, using Palestinian lives not as human lives but as bargaining chips, but Israel has economically and politically benefited from its occupation over the decades, but so have other countries. Surrounding countries have benefited from Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory, and different countries that have economic and political relations with Israel have benefited from this. So when we're talking sanctions, what we must first try and better understand is who is benefiting from the existing system of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And then we can understand how we can push forward for sanctions. And the sanctions have to be broad-based, because the entire Israeli legal and political system, again, is designed to continue to attempt to annex Palestinian territory. And my final point, again, is there's currently an arrest warrant for Prime Minister Netanyahu and former Minister of Defense Gallant. And one of the core elements of the allegations is starvation. It's the first time an international criminal warrant has been issued for the crime of starvation. But the fact that we're still seeing starvation unfold, and the fact that starvation is only possible through a system, it's not just bad people, it's a system, it means many more individuals are guilty. Many more individuals should be held accountable for starvation crimes and other war crimes.
Thank you, Mr. Fakhri. Are there any other questions? Yes, please go ahead.
Based on Ms. Anadolu, Mr. Fakhri, you just said that there are arrest warrants and because of starvation as well. But we know that some of the European countries already said that they're not going to follow this arrest. What do you think about it, and how this remarks would define the implication of such laws? Thank you.
So I'll just answer in sort of a preliminary way and then answer more directly. There was an interview with Prosecutor Khan from the ICC about how, with the pressure he received when he issued these arrest warrants. And what he said in this public interview is that many European political leaders were surprised, because they said that the ICC was designed to go after African leaders. So then when European countries, being consistent in saying we're not going to honor and adhere to these arrest warrants, is a continuation of their racism. Not just hypocrisy, their racism.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Sorry, yes.
Just to add to Michael's answer on that question, I think it illustrates the point that this kind of selectivity in the enforcement of international law is so dangerous, because it sends a signal to everybody else that you don't have to comply with international law either. And for so long, there's been a very strong and growing narrative of double standards in international law, that those who made the law view it as applying to others, but not themselves. And then it's no surprise when, you know, other states don't do the West's bidding and enforce all the things that the Western states would like enforced to support them. And I think that's very dangerous, because it's not just about Gaza or the Palestinians. It has ripple effects across the whole legal system. And we've seen that there are all kinds of attacks on international institutions and fundamental norms of international law. And once those red lines start getting eroded so forcefully, it doesn't take long for the system to break down and break apart very quickly. I think we've seen an example of this in your country, the United States, where a very strong, old, sophisticated legal and political system is disintegrating before our eyes in a matter of weeks. Law can only do so much. You need political commitments from governments to enforce the law, and we can't oppose Russia in Ukraine for the last few years, and then when it comes to Gaza, norms and institutions no longer matter. Last week, I was really disturbed, actually, that the Conference of States Parties to the Geneva Conventions here in Geneva didn't go ahead because states were so far apart on enforcement of the most fundamental rules of international law. I mean, humanitarian law is not very demanding, actually. These are minimum basic rules of humane conduct. Don't torture people, don't summarily execute people, don't bomb hospitals. It's not asking much, actually. And when we can't agree on enforcing those absolute fundamentals, I think the world has gone to a very, very dark place.
Thank you, Professor Sal. Ms. Satterthwaite should also weigh in.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So I would have said a lot of what has already been said, and so I won't repeat it. But what I will say is that even as we are seeing this disintegration, it is time for those states that are supporting the ICC and that do believe in an equal application of international criminal law, international human rights law, to really lean in and take action now. So we have seen some very strong leadership from some states saying, we will enforce the arrest warrants. We will continue to support the ICC. But one thing that I think would be very important is to see the EU activating its blocking statute vis-a-vis these sanctions. The EU does have that capacity to act together to activate this protective statute, which would go a long way to saying, not only do we support the ICC, but we will protect it from this kind of unilateral action. So that's important. And then also important is for us to see that leadership on these issues is shifting. We see leadership coming from the Global South in many cases. We see leadership of states who are going to these international mechanisms, going to the ICC, going to the International Criminal Court, bringing evidence and bringing support. And it's time for states to recognize that we must be looking to where leadership's coming from and putting our actions where our words are. And I agree entirely with my colleagues that it's time for us to honestly face the double standards, the racism that has been inherent in those double standards, and to call on the states that have been quietly sitting by to stand up and be very clear on their support and their active participation in ensuring international law is enforced.
Thank you. We have a question in the room. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Dina Abisab. I represent several Arabic media. I have two questions, actually. The first one, Mrs. Albanese mentioned that media or journalists in general played a role on the coverage of this subject. How do you think, my question goes to all of you, how do you think media was useful or not, especially when you talked about smearing and campaigns against you as in this job? My second question goes to Mr. Michael Fakhri. You always said that what's going on in Gaza is a genocide. But do you think that what happened in Gaza and in the West Bank can be also a kind of apartheid food on the Palestinian people? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go to Ms. Albanese first and then back to Mr. Fakhri. Thank you.
Yes. Look, I'm not a media expert, but I've done quite a significant amount of reading about ethical journalism, because I had an issue with the media was covering the facts and developments in the occupied Palestinian territory since October 2023, and not because there were not enough reasons to do that, to have that critical approach before. But there are some key principles, like truth and accuracy, according to which journalists should strive to give an accurate and fair account of events. And I don't think this has happened, because in many instances there has been a repetition of unverified facts, very often coming from disputed or not very credible sources. The other principle is independence. Journalists and certain media have been investigated by other journalists as not truly independent. They have masked themselves, they have hidden themselves against the behind the word neutrality, but they have taken side. They have been biased in the ways they have selected facts to report on, and voices to host, and also the kind of different line of questionings and the assumptions, sometimes revealing a racial bias again in the line of questions. The other elements are really fairness and impartiality. We know now, because it's been increasingly exposed, and there are also cases where I have received complaints myself, and I've listened to and I've received, I mean, I've heard, I've spoken with journalists themselves who have been either fired, dismissed, or mistreated in their position, told not to talk about genocide, not to talk about war crimes against or crimes against humanity. So there has been like a thought police in between quote and quote in the media. So I think that as in other genocides, the role of the media will have to be investigated, because in international tribunals have exposed the role of media, for example, in enabling, in creating a conducive environment for genocidal acts in the case of Rwanda and in the case of former Yugoslavia. What is interesting here, as I've said before, it's a case where it's not the Israeli media, or it's not the Israeli media only. It's international media, corporate media, Western media, which has taken this conduct, and it's very regrettable.
Thank you. Mr. Fakhri, please go ahead.
I'll start just with what the International Court of Justice has said and then build on that analysis. So in the recent International Court of Justice advisory opinion on the legal consequences of Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory since 1967, the court held that Israel's occupation is some case of racial segregation or apartheid, without clarifying which one. But it was very clear that Israel is engaged in the most severe form of racist policy. To turn to the specific concept of apartheid, building on decades of work, both from within the United Nations and amongst international legal experts, I align myself with those that recognize that it is the most extreme form of racial segregation in that it is apartheid. What that means is this. Why does it matter? Naming things matters. It means that it's not just that Israel systemically and regularly implements its laws and policies in a way that is racist and dehumanizes the Palestinian people. When we say it is apartheid, what that means is the Israeli legal and political regime, as constructed institutionally, is designed to dehumanize the Palestinian people, and in this case, for the purpose of displacing them from their territory. That's why, again, to turn back to what is to be done, the issue of sanctions is important. The court requires all member states of the United Nations to impose sanctions against Israel, jointly and individually, to end the illegal occupation. One can interpret this narrowly, meaning You can then, if you're a country, you can say, okay, I'm going to impose sanctions against Israel to end its illegal occupation, but I'm only going to look at Israel's presence on the ground in the occupied territories. But if you understand it as a system of racial segregation, as an apartheid, that means you have to apply sanctions against Israel as such, against the entire state of Israel, because it is constructed institutionally to undermine the humanity of the Palestinian people. Because of this apartheid regime then, and I'm not the first to say this and I won't be the last, and is why Israel has been able to starve the people so quickly. The food system is designed to undermine the strength of the Palestinian people. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Fakri. Are there any other questions in the room or online for the special rapporteurs? They have a little bit more time.
I'll just add on the media question. We've also been concerned about the Palestinian authorities' banning of Al Jazeera, which I don't think is obviously very helpful or consistent with freedom of expression and freedom of the media. To echo what Francesca said about censorship of and attacks on journalists, you know, in my country, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, which is our national public broadcaster, took a radio announcer off air because she simply retweeted a Human Rights Watch report about Palestine with no comment. I mean, this is the level of censorship that's going on because people are afraid of the kinds of pressure that all kinds of institutions are getting from organized political forces, whether they be the media, universities, public servants. This kind of intense polarization around the space to advocate on these issues has been incredibly destructive to debate on these issues. The weaponization of anti-Semitism, the efforts to ensure the International Holocaust Remembrance definition of anti-Semitism is taken up by as many states and institutions as possible when it's deeply flawed. As has been pointed out in numerous reports by special rapporteurs over the years, including Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, the former Special Rapporteur on Racism. I mean, it's very clear that those are very problematic definitions that can't be squared with freedom of expression under international law. So that space to speak on these issues really needs to be protected and expanded, whether it's in the media, in universities, or elsewhere. Thank you.
That was Ben Saul, UN Special Rapporteur on the Promotion and Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms While Countering Terrorism, speaking March 12, 2025 at the press conference in Geneva by UN human rights experts. His comments on free expression were made as mass protests erupted around the United States demanding the release of Mahmoud Khalil from immigration custody. Khalil is a leader of pro-Palestine protests at Columbia University, a green card holder, and is married to an American citizen who is 8 months pregnant.
And that's it for today's show. This is On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, voices of resistance from the nation's capital, on 24 stations on the Pacifica Radio Network, on all your podcast platforms at On the Ground with Esther Evarim, and on our website, onthegroundshow.org. In addition to communicating with us on our website, you can let us know you like the show on Twitter, Facebook, and on patreon.com at On the Ground Show. Or also link to every show on my Instagram page, which is Esther_Evarim. That's ESTHER_IVLikeVictor ERM like Mary. And our theme music for the show is Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix. I'm Esther Evarim. Until next time, take good care and keep raising your voice. Peace. We'll be right back.
Rebecca Miles, and I'll be hosting a new show called Frontline Voices, which will air Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays at 12 noon, starting this Friday.